This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me?
Organize everybody after Katrina because FEMA. You ready for me, Russell? This is Wade Bratsky. Russell, are we on? Okay, this is Wade Bratsky. You're listening to Wage World, the Voice of the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wage World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west where we are either rebroadcast are live streamed at KABF.org, WAMF.org, or AcornRadio.org. Podcasts will be available of this show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. And today we're talking to Aaron Haddon, a professor at the University of Buffalo, who's written a very interesting book, at least to us, called Coercion, Work Under Threat of Punishment. Aaron, welcome to Wage World.
Hi, Wade. Thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure, Professor Haddon. So this book has an interesting thesis. I'll let you tell it, but basically you look at four groups of workers we might not put in the same bushel, but they come out in your grinder in the same way. Tell us what you tried to do in this book.
That's right. So, you know, I didn't start out to study labor coercion, but that's what it ended up being about. And so in this book, I analyzed four very different groups of workers. And let me just say right here that I do not argue that they're the same in virtually any way. So I looked at incarcerated workers, you know, people who are in prison and have to work basically as part of their incarceration. I looked at workfare workers. These are welfare recipients who are required to perform labor in order to receive their public benefits. I also looked at college athletes, Division I football and basketball players, as well as graduate students in the sciences. So these are really, really different groups of workers, right? Particularly in terms of their marginalization and their disadvantage and their vulnerability to power and abuse. But despite those differences, I argue that they all experience a similar type of labor coercion. Their bosses wield vast, expansive, punitive power over them, for instance, for prisoners being able to throw them in solitary confinement if they don't do the job or do it right, according to the officer, or for college athletes, taking away their scholarship, kicking them out of school, or hindering their professional career, right? So in all of these cases, they experience a similar type of labor coercion.
I actually, before I founded Acorn in the late 60s and early 1970s, organized welfare recipients. I was head organizer of Massachusetts Welfare Rights, the largest affiliate of the National Welfare Rights. So I was particularly interested in workfare. Oh, my God, we fought against workfare. Mm-hmm. And so did Acorn. But this is not something people really understand. And our own Arkans and Bill Clinton disappointed us greatly since we knew him well with his changing welfare as we know it. But explain a little bit more just so that people know what college athletes are like. They pretty much know what prisoners are like. They'll talk more about graduate students. But workfare is a confusing kind of situation under the law, isn't it?
Yes, right. I mean, in various ways and to different degrees, all of these groups of workers aren't counted as workers under the law. And that's definitely part of the issue. And that's why it kind of what helps give their bosses free rein, this kind of expansive power over them. But yeah, so workfare is an interesting case. It really expanded radically, as you noted, under Bill Clinton when he, quote unquote, ended welfare as we know it with welfare reform. And so expanded these programs in which, in order to get public assistance, welfare recipients needed to work. And this was premised on the whole idea that, the false idea that people who were seeking public assistance, A, hadn't been working, B, didn't know how to work, and C, didn't want to work. And so it was this false myth, this myth that they needed to be compelled to labor in order to receive public assistance. And so you see in New York City, at least until recently, people being put to work cleaning subway cars as part of their receipt of public assistance, or picking up trash in the parks, or sometimes working in nonprofit agencies doing administrative work, though more often than not it's janitorial work. And so they're compelled to labor 25 or 35 hours a week. In exchange, they'll get whatever kind of benefits they might qualify for from the state. But the problem here, well, there are multiple problems here, but one problem is that this doing this labor, which is quite menial, it actually prevents them from finding, quote, real work. They don't have time to go out and put in job applications because they only get childcare support when they're working. So this prevents them from doing the very thing that the program officials claim that it's going to do, is help them get back into the labor force.
We actually, you may remember the New York program called WEP Workers, Work Employment Program in the city
That's
of
right.
New York. We actually organized those welfare recipients as workers, and it's very interesting, demanded that they be recognized, forced an independent election run by arbitrators, and we ended up losing largely because AFSCME District 37 accreted those workers and then didn't know what to do with them. So, but the coercion part of it, and that's the name of Professor Haddon's book, is that they are workfare recipients. Besides this not being, as one of your stories told, real work or a real job, as many of the recipients feel, they also are constantly threatened for the least kinds of offenses that they will be terminated from the program, in which case they're forced into even a more dire situation of poverty.
Oh, that's absolutely right. So what many people don't quite realize, unless they've experienced it firsthand, is that our welfare system in the U.S. is incredibly punitive. It's incredibly mean-spirited. So the way it's implemented now is that people are kept out any way possible. But if they manage to squeeze in, and you have to be in dire need in order to get benefits from the state, if you manage to squeeze in, you're put to work in this way, but they're always hanging over you the threat of kicking you off. But what that means is when they kick you off, when they sanction you, they take away your benefits, all the while your so-called clock of benefits keeps ticking. Your lifetime allotment keeps going away, even as you do not receive benefits. And for many people, they end up on the streets, homeless. Or, as I talked to one veteran who had been a workfare worker in New York City, he said that people who were already living in homeless shelters, if they were sanctioned from the system for any reason at all, and there are all sorts of reasons, including many, many, many false, incorrect reasons while people are sanctioned, but if you're sanctioned while living in a homeless shelter, you'll be kicked out of the homeless shelter. People end up on the streets. And this is the type of power that workfare bosses wield over workers.
And there are countless examples as well of people who are not willing to apply for welfare now because of the stringency of these requirements. This came up over and over again in the well-known book Evicted a couple of years ago, and they were looking at the sort of situation in Milwaukee. And I don't think people realize it's only 5 years is the maximum. What did we do in the pandemic? I mean, they couldn't get we got 30-something, 40 million people unemployed, so you can hardly believe that welfare recipients are going to be running into new jobs because those jobs don't exist. But the clock is still ticking for them, even if they're lucky enough to have gotten on and to still receive the benefit.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And along with this system being incredibly punitive, I mean, along with that is that it's mean-spirited. People are actively and repeatedly, in fact, continually degraded while in the system. And it's deeply demoralizing and dehumanizing for these people.
Well, you use the word subjugation, not only with welfare or workfare recipients, but many others. It was, you know, a lot of people would have who are listening, and it's a more select group than millions of people who receive welfare benefits. But it was interesting to see your discussion of graduate students, PhD students, and the the thin line they have to walk in order, particularly in the science field, in order to be able to sort of get out the other end with a PhD and a possible career. Explain how that works to people.
Yeah, that's right. You know, some of the dimensions of graduate student work in the sciences were even a surprise to me because, you know, I was also a graduate student, but I was in sociology, not in the life sciences, like biology and chemistry and so on. And so what I learned through doing interviews with former graduate students is that in the sciences, basically, when you're getting a PhD, your whole education is also, at the same time, a labor relation. You are working in your advisor's lab, doing your advisor's research. So they don't embark on their own research agendas for their dissertations. They're doing their advisor's research. Their advisor owns that research. They own any publications that come out of that research. They own any inventions or patents that come out of it as well. And so it's totally a labor relation. But their bosses, and they often call their advisors their bosses, which is very different from my field as well, their bosses, their advisors, have enormous power over them because they determine whether they can keep their funding and stay in the degree. Also, when they become really good workers at the end of their degree, the bosses, their faculty advisors, have power over whether they can leave. And over again, students said that it was a totally common practice for advisors to prevent their students from leaving with a degree, getting their PhD, defending their dissertation, to prevent them because they had become productive workers in the lab. And another key source of their power is a letter of recommendation. So your advisor essentially acts as a gatekeeper, and a very strong one, to professional opportunities after graduate school. The letter of recommendation either makes or breaks their career opportunities.
Well, there have been many, many studies that indicate that most people find jobs through a network of relationships, not, going on Craigslist or, the old days newspaper ads. I mean, somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody who you know puts you in the way of a job where they're working. And you up the stakes when you talk about the academic world because you can be as easily blacklisted as, green-lighted into another and better position. So it's a surprising thing. We're talking to Professor Aaron Hatton, who's written a book called Coerced, Working the Threat of Punishment. In the paper today, as we're talking, you saw the head of the NCAA, former college president Mark Emmert, trying to make the case not to pay or to have one system of paying college athletes. How does that break in your look?
Yeah, so I also interviewed former college football players and basketball players as part of my research for this book. And, the dimensions of power that their coaches wield over them are so broad and so strong. I only interview people who are former college athletes, right? But for some of them, even still, maybe they're out of college 4, 6, 8 years, they were still nervous talking to me about their college career. And maybe their college career as an athlete wasn't even bad, right? It wasn't necessarily that they were revealing some kind of terrible thing that happened. It was just they were fearful because their coaches wield and have always wielded so much power over them. Even if they don't, those levers are not very practical anymore. They've moved on in their career. But look, athletes work, and they work hard day in and day out for college athletics. But the NCAA and universities have restricted, so many things about their lives. They prevented them from talking to the media or posting on social media. They prevent them from earning money, running a camp in the summertime when they're off of school. They prevent them from moving easily between teams, right? So they have such limited mobility. And also, their coaches have this kind of punitive power over them. They can keep them from playing, which takes away the apex of their athletic experience. They can take away their scholarship and thus their education. And just like graduate students, they can intervene and give them basically a bad recommendation to professional recruiters and impede their professional career.
And anyone, whether you've been a class one NCAA player or not, anybody who's even played high school football or anything else, knows the power of coaches. So that certainly rang true. And in many cases, it goes without saying, they're sacrificing their academic career, trying to chase either the coach's orders or the gold ring of maybe ending up in the very short-lived professional career. So it was a sad story to read, but it certainly rings true now over and over again. Of course, prisoners is a harder situation, but you go into that as well because obviously they work for peanuts anyway and are in a difficult situation.
That's right. So in New York State, incarcerated workers do get paid a little bit, between usually 10 and 33 cents an hour. In some states, they don't get paid anything for the labor that they are effectively required to perform. They work, and you know what? By the way, I'm not against work. I don't hate work. In fact, I think work in this culture is revered, and I, too, believe that work can be an important source of meaning and dignity and rights and respect. But the problem in these cases is that, especially for prisoners, is that work is not a source of any of those things. In fact, it's, well, at least for most of them. That's not always true, but for most of them. For most of the time, it's a source of degradation and disrespect. But, you know, prisoners, in theory, prison labor could be productive, could be a way of building skills, could be a way of getting much needed money to live behind bars, because in fact, living in prison is kind of expensive, and they need the money. So I'm not against prison labor per se, but the exploitation and the degradation and the coercion that they experience through their labor behind bars, I am, of course, absolutely against.
Well, yeah, coercion is the issue, as you say in your book. I mean, we're broadcast in three stations in Mississippi, Arkansas, and Louisiana, all of which have notorious prisons, whether we're talking about Cummins or Parchman or Angola. So that's part of the reason that I want to, if we go in that hole, we'll never get out, Professor Haddon.
we're just going to... It is a deep and dark hole.
Yeah, we're just going to say prisoners, you know, and even people you've interviewed in your book were clear. They didn't resent the notion of work or say that their crime didn't deserve perhaps not getting paid, you know, federal minimum wage. But the fact, as you say, that we can't pretend that any of this work is not coercive or has to do with rehabilitation. I mean, there's not a future in making license plates. There's not a future in soybean and cotton farming. For mass numbers of prisoners in the South. So, I mean, that's you can't get around that, can you?
No, that's right. And in no employment relation, including behind bars, should the boss have the power to throw you in solitary confinement for an unlimited amount of time for any reason at all, right? That is simply not a punishment that any boss in a labor relation should be able to wield over their workers.
And it has, I mean, all the studies indicate things like solitary confinement have permanent damage. Now, in some cases, and we're talking to Professor Erin Haddon about her book, Coerced, Work Under Threat of Punishment, both for graduate students and certainly in Northwestern, we saw situations where people in your study zone tried to organize unions.
That's right. I mean, there has been... I don't want to say it's growing anew because among all of these groups, you know, you said you organized workfare workers back in the 70s and they're the welfare rights movement. I mean, there have been lots of pushes over time among these groups to organize, to make rights claims. Although I guess for the two student groups, that's a more recent phenomenon, in part because they've been more overtly exploited and coerced with kind of the neoliberalization of higher education. But yes, they have been pushing to unionize. They have been pushing to claim rights. They have been pushing for recognition that they are workers and that they should have at least some limited economic freedoms and rights as such.
And in some cases, graduate students have successfully created unions and even resolved collective bargaining relationships back to University of Wisconsin and some public institutions particularly, but... Under the National Labor Relations Board, they had a little bit of sunshine with the Obama board, but the Trump board has been retracting some of the rights for unions to organize, haven't they?
That's right. In fact, I was a graduate student at the University of Wisconsin and a proud member of the TAA, the union there. And yes, they have.
Well, this is a small world, Erin.
I know.
I mean, I'm amazed we haven't met before now, but yeah.
I know. As I mentioned to Wade earlier, I mentioned him and his campaign and with SEIU in my first book. Anyway, yes, so the graduate students have been pushing to organize and they're still pushing to organize, and they have been facing a lot of bumps in the road with the original rules of the NLRA and the current NLRB.
Including at very prestigious universities. It's been amazing to read some of the stories of Yale and Harvard and others and the lengths they've gone to try to prevent this organization.
That is right. And it is amazing. And I discuss some of the rhetoric they use in my book. You know, the kind of are the rhetorical gymnastics they use to argue that these graduate students are not real workers because they're getting an education, because they're getting opportunities, because they're lucky, because they're privileged. And so they use all sorts of strategies to claim that the work they do is not really work.
Prisoners have been a more difficult group. I mean, there have been some bleeps every once in a while of unions of sorts, associations of prisoners being organized. And certainly we hear about, food boycotts and strikes in prisons. There was one in Oklahoma and several other prisons just over the last year. This must be desperate for people who are in prison under those kinds of subjugations to try to organize.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to different degrees and different extents, but for all of these workers, they face very harsh consequences for their institutions. If they try to organize and push back against the limits that are imposed on them. But, of course, that is by far the harshest for prisoners. There were waves of prisoner organizing and pushes, very strong and real pushes for prison unions. But then they were legally banned in, I believe it was the 70s. And since then, they've largely been quashed. But that does not mean that prisoner activism has been quashed. But whenever they're active, whenever they push back against the system, really in any way, they do so at great risk, including physical violence, as well as being moved to a different prison and separated, you know, far from their families and friends and loved ones. They do so at great personal and bodily risk.
We need to have at least some way to look at what might be something of a better world in these situations. In your book, and you're thinking research on this, Professor, what would be an advance forward for these kinds of subjugated, coerced workers?
Well, you know, there for any of these systems and for all of them together, one can think of both small improvements and large improvements. So, you know, for prisoners, of course, I would argue that we need to abolish and radically reconceptualize the criminal justice system, right? That's the big change that needs to happen. But there are smaller changes that can make real improvements for prisoners and incarcerated labor workers' lives, like removing solitary confinement, which does nothing but harm people in the long term. It does not help. It does not protect. It only harms prisoners in a profound way. So removing solitary confinement, making labor behind bars something that gives people real skills that they can actually use and help them connect to jobs rather than being discriminated from jobs after incarceration. Because remember, people are in and out of prison, right? These are people, members of our community. We want them to be people who can take part in the community. So helping them do that is an important part of any type of rehabilitative incarceration.
We could say the same thing for workfare welfare recipients, couldn't we, in terms
Absolutely.
Of being trained and processed into real jobs, which is, I mean, knowing too many welfare recipients, whatever, the issue is not that people don't want to work, it's that work is not available within, you know, the world and capacity that they're able to access it.
That's right. I mean, so the people that I talk to and study after study shows, you know, just like any of us who believe in the importance of work, so do people who happen to be on public assistance at any given time. They believe in work, and they also often believe and buy into the stigmatization of welfare, and they feel bad for being there, but they're just down on their luck, and they're stuck in this very difficult economy where they're having trouble making their way up. So we need to totally reconceive a system which helps people be included and productive in the economy rather than marginalizing and excluding them.
It's ironic that if we really looked at these four groups of coerced workers that you studied, the most hopeful you can be is the situation of graduate students. I mean, if you read Science magazine and whatever, I mean, many of them are starting to be able to voice the issues with abusive professors. There's starting to be some push for reform. As I mentioned earlier, the NCAA is caught now on this. Three states have now said that college athletes can be paid, at least at some level. So those occupations that are higher status, higher education, that have to do with college athletes and graduate students, there seems to be a real chance of reform for them. But welfare recipients and prisoners still seem to be, you know, pretty much out of luck.
That's largely the case.
Am I being too cynical?
No, unfortunately you're not. It is largely true. I mean, there has been a real momentum around the two student groups, although I will say the activities they've undertaken to gain the momentum have come at real risk as well, you know.
Sure.
But yeah, they are making changes. But though it should be noted that there's no horizon for universities to actually pay the athletes. They're just letting them be paid for their athleticism by other entities. They're not allowing corporations to take advantage of them and use their likenesses in video games and make $1 million off of them while the athletes can make nothing, right? So they're changing those rules. But no one's talking about actually remunerating the athletes themselves for the labor they do for universities. So they are making changes. And there's real kind of energy and optimism around those groups because those are really important changes to be made. For prisoners and for workfare, you know, it's
a harder road.
Optimistic, yes.
Erin, tell people how they can get your book, Coerced Work Under Threat of Punishment.
Yeah, sure. So it's available at all the usual places. It's on Amazon. It's also, you can get it from the University of California Press website. It's called Coerced Work Under Threat of Punishment. You can also find me at my website, erinhatton.com, and you can see links to the book there.
And if people want to continue this conversation or have questions for you, can they find a way to contact you through your website, or is there another way?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm on Twitter, eehatton, and I'm also, my email is readily available, eehatton@buffalo.edu.
Excellent. This has been Wade's World for another week, The World Where the Other Half Lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wade's World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change based in Little Rock, Arkansas. And as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rathke for Wade's World. Thank you.